Eddie, the Collegiate Sophomore. Chapter 8. Summer Break, Part 1. Right after semester break at the university, Officer Richard Hayes drops by the service station early one morning to give Eddie some news. Officer Hayes has worked hard taking down the gambling ring that was fixing the outcome of high school and college sporting events. After taking Dean Grimsby in, Officer Hayes went on a well-needed vacation. Eddie has not seen Officer Hayes since the spring divisional meet. Walking back to the service area, Officer Hayes yells out, "Hey, my engine's running rough. I think I need a new Johnson rod." Seeing Officer Hayes, Eddie yells back, "I'm sorry. We're all out of them." Eddie then asks, "How was Florida?" Richard explains, "The kids didn't want to come home. They kept asking why I can't get a job down there. And Sandy really wanted to go away on vacation. The baby is due in about a month, and once the baby comes, that's about it for vacation for a year." Eddie replies, "I'm glad that you guys had a great time." After catching up for a while, Richard tells Eddie, "You'll never guess what went down after the undercover guys took Grimsby away." Eddie asks, "Did Grimsby squeal?" Richard explains, "Better. They had Grimsby convinced that Bill Fusco was laying on the bottom of a river, and if he didn't take them to the boss, he was going to end up there too." Having a few run-ins with Dean Grimsby, Eddie laughs, telling Richard, "I wish I could have seen that." Richard asks Eddie, "Guess who the ringleader was?" Eddie replies, "Kathy is convinced it's Mr. Crumb's rich uncle." Quite surprised, Richard replies, "Wow. Kathy was spot on. It was Alistair Crumb. He's sitting in a jail cell now." Eddie adds, "She had it figured out when she heard that Crumb's uncle paid Mark in cash for that wall he built." Richard asks Eddie, "Do you remember all the theatrics that Maurice Crumb pulled at the end of the trial about how they were going to come after him and kill him?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. He really broke down." Richard explains, "Well, it was all theatrics. He was protecting his uncle. No one was going to come after him and kill him. All of his bawling and hammering his fist on the table backfired. If he had kept his mouth shut, the case may not have been reopened. This John Davies character is a genius." Richard then informs Eddie, "We made a few other arrests shortly afterwards. Do you want to venture a guess as to who they were?" Eddie replies, "Why does the name McCrutchen come to mind?" Richard explains, "Scott McCutchen Sr. was involved, but we didn't arrest him. The only job that character has on record is a department manager at a supermarket. His lifestyle suggests that he is a brain surgeon or something." Eddie asks, "Why didn't you arrest him?" Richard replies, "Without his gambling income, he'll lose his house and his cars. He's going to be pretty ticked off. He'll get what's coming to him. And he's on our list. We'll be watching him." Eddie asks, "So, who else got arrested?" Richard replies, "The Centerville coach, James Ruff, and the Henderson coach, Rudy Parker. This Rudy Parker character was a real piece of work. He's also charged with assaulting an officer." Eddie exclaims, "Wow. Mr. Ruff. Mr. Fraser is going to shit a brick." Richard explains, "This James Ruff character was working with Scott McCutchen Sr. and his three kids, Scott Jr., Todd, and Jeff, to fix races. The coach at Henderson, Rudy Parker, was also in on the operation. Apparently, Parker and Ruff are good friends. They tried to work with Maurice Crumb, but, apparently, this Mr. Crumb had little control over his high school teams." Eddie replies, "That's because Mr. Zunday kept that little shithead in check." Richard then informs Eddie, "Once we were done, we took in about 24 perpetrators, but you probably wouldn't know the others. We have a few more that we'll be taking in." Richard fills Eddie in on a few other details, revealing to Eddie that the gambling operation was originally bigger than Eddie thought. Finally, with some answers, Eddie is assured that future sporting events will be fair and not rigged. Eddie and Richard talk a bit about the financial markets. Richard has made a considerable amount of money by following Eddie's stock recommendations. Richard thanks Eddie for his help in the investigation and heads back out on patrol. Eddie gets back to work, thinking there will finally be peace in track and field. This year, Eddie and Kathy usher in the summer with a pool party at their home. On the guest list is anyone from either the university or high school track team who wants to come, McCutcheon excluded. But Mr. Fraser pretty much cut McCutcheon from the team by officially placing him on the injured reserve list. McCutcheon hasn't shown up at practice since Kathy kicked the crap out of him. The rumor is that McCutcheon has applied at another university. No one is sad to see him go. As the morning moves on, the guests arrive a few at a time. Looking at the parking area, it is easy to come to the conclusion that, today, there is a June buggy convention at Eddie and Kathy's house. By mid-morning, nearly everyone has arrived. Everyone is expecting pizza, and no one wants to miss out. Among the last to arrive is Karen Coy, who drives up and gets out of her car. Standing next to her car and looking around, Karen takes in the beautiful setting around Eddie and Kathy's home. Walking toward the door, Karen reconsiders and heads back toward her car, planning to leave. Kathy walks out the door exclaiming, "Karen, I'm so glad you can make it." Karen wipes the tears from her eyes, turns around, and replies, "Oh, hey. This place is so beautiful and serene." Perceiving that something is bothering Karen, Kathy asks, "Are you okay?" Obviously bothered about something, Karen replies, "I'll be okay." As Kathy and Karen walk inside, Karen asks Kathy, "Is this your parents' house?" Kathy replies, "No. Me and Eddie live here." Glancing over at the medal collection on the wall, Karen replies, "Your home is really beautiful." "Wow." Kathy tells Karen, "Let me show you around." Kathy shows Karen around the inside of the house and the gym downstairs. They then head out to the pool area, where most of the guests are congregated. Looking at the pool, Karen mentions, "Wow. Your pool is really beautiful too." Kathy mentions, "And that table where Erica and Bobby B are sitting is where I did my homework." Karen recalls, "That's right. You were a senior this year. I'll miss you next year." Kathy informs Karen, "I'll still be at the university. I got accepted to graduate school, and I'll be helping out with the team next year." Karen replies, "Wow. That's really awesome." Kathy asks Karen, "Did you bring your swimsuit?" Karen replies, "Yeah. It's in my car." Kathy offers, "Go ahead and change and join us in the pool." Karen goes to her car to get her swimsuit and heads back inside to change. Janice, who graduated 2 years ago, walks up and tells Kathy, "Hey, I heard you guys won all the gold medals at the divisional meet." Kathy replies, "We did. That was really amazing." Kathy asks, "So, how is teaching working out?" Janice explains, "I love it. I'm at a high school, and I'm the assistant track coach." Kathy tells Janice, "Barbara is the coach at Northside now." Janice replies, "I heard. I saw her at State. We had one guy going this year. Barbara really has a great team." Kathy asks, "What school are you at?" Janice explains, "Right now, I'm at Northport, but I have an application in at Springfield. That was my high school." Kathy sighs and tells Janice, "I want to teach elementary school, but I also wouldn't mind coaching track. I guess that means I'll be the field day coordinator." Janice tells Kathy, "Start training them early. That will make a big difference." Kathy and Janice then head out to the pool and mingle with the crowd. At the pool, Kathy yells out, "Hey, everybody. Janice is here. The university team members who ran with Janice all come over and give her a hug. The team members who have not met Janice, having heard a lot about her, finally get to meet her. Janice catches her former teammates up on life after college, assuring them that there actually is a life after college. Not knowing that Janice has arrived are a few of the guys, who are downstairs in the middle of a bench press competition. Pete Mendenhall made the challenge, which was quickly taken up by Bobby B. Fabio Cinquegrana, Braden, Mark, Johnson, and a few others joined the competition, but everyone suspects Bobby B. or Mendenhall will win. Erica and Tessa, the rivals on the track, and now in the gym, join in, competing against each other. Eddie decided to sit this one out, only because he is the host of the party. With £200 on the bar, Erica and Tessa are still at it. Erica and Tessa have both bench pressed this weight before. It's Tessa's turn, and she gets onto the bench. Lifting the bar off the hooks, Tessa lowers the bar to her chest and, putting in an awesome effort, completes the lift. Erica is next, who has been making it look easy. Erica raises the bar, lowers it to her chest, and easily completes the lift. The weight is raised to 210 pounds. A few of the guys take a warm-up set at this weight as Tessa gets psyched up. Getting onto the bench, Tessa is all fired up. Lowering the bar, Tessa seriously does not want to let Erica win. Letting out a primal scream, Tessa raises the bar, setting a new personal record. The guys cheer and are amazed that Tessa actually completed the lift. Now Erica's turn, she is surprised that Tessa has even gone this far in the competition. Lowering the bar, Erica is able to raise the bar and has not yet had to resort to her primal scream to help her in the lift. Now at 225 pounds, the bar poses a challenge for Tessa. Both Erica and Tessa know this, but Tessa appears outwardly confident. Tessa gets onto the bench, staring intently at the bar. As Tessa lowers the bar, Erica hopes that Tessa has finally met her match. Tessa raises the bar, but halfway through the lift, she is unable to follow through, and the bar slowly drops to her chest. The spotters, Mark and Cinquegrana, lift the bar off Tessa's chest. Tessa is now hoping for a tie. Erica gets onto the bench, and knowing that this is her last attempt, is all fired up. Erica lowers the bar and, letting out a primal scream, raises the bar. Erica completes the lift, winning today's competition between her and Tessa. The guys cheer, congratulating both Tessa and Erica on an awesome contest. During the guys' competition, Erica curiously asks Tessa, "So, how did you get so good?" Tessa explains, "I hit a plateau in the water, so I've been cross-training. I had to do something, so I've been hitting the gym every day before classes. And now that the summer is here, I'll have more time to train." Erica asks, "You wouldn't want a training partner for the summer, would you?" Tessa replies, "Sure. You can join me." Erica then explains, "I'm also helping Mark and Bobby B with construction this summer. I'll have to work around that. They are working on Dr. Akinmola's church." Tessa tells Erica, "I don't know what I'm doing this summer." Erica yells out to Mark, "Hey, Mark. Tessa needs a job." Mark walks over and tells Tessa, "Oh yeah." Tessa replies, "Yeah. I'm looking around." Mark tells Tessa, "Most of where we need help right now is with outside muddy boot jobs. It's a good workout. Are you interested?" Tessa replies, "Sure. Sign me up." So, for the summer, Tessa will be working on construction projects, getting in a different type of cross-training than she expected. After a few rounds, with 425 pounds on the bar, the competition is still alive among the guys. Cinquegrana went out at this weight, but bench pressing 405 pounds in the previous round still puts him among an elite group. Bobby B., Braden, and Mendenhall are still in. From what has been seen so far, Everyone fully expects that Bobby B will win. The weight is raised to 435 pounds. Using a little psychological warfare, Bobby B announces, "I think I'll sit out this round. You guys fight it out for second place." Bobby B relaxes on a bench, watching as Mendenhall prepares to lift the weight. Lowering the weight, Mendenhall appears a little shaky. Raising the weight, Mendenhall gets the bar 3/4 of the way there, but cannot complete the lift. Braden, all fired up, wastes no time getting onto the bench. Lifting the bar, Braden lowers it to his chest and, with all the energy he can find, successfully completes the lift. Everyone cheers, knowing that Braden's lift is a significant accomplishment. Mark asks, "What are we raising the weight to?" Bobby B suggests, "How about 495 pounds? Braden exclaims, "You're crazy." Bobby B smiles and tells Mark, "I'm getting hungry. Let's get this over with. I'll go first, since I sat out the last round. Give me 495. Mark and Cinquegrana add 60 pounds to the bar and get into position to spot Bobby B. With confidence, Bobby B gets onto the bench. Bobby B raises the bar, quickly lowers it, and lets out his own primal scream as he raises the bar. Successfully completing the lift, Bobby B has everyone convinced that he is not yet near his limit. The crowd cheers and gives Bobby B high fives. It's not hard to see how Bobby B can toss Liggett or McCutcheon around like a rag doll. Braden, pacing back and forth, looks worried, but he will not allow himself to lose by default. Getting onto the bench, Braden appears very confident. Braden would look quite confident in the cockpit of an airplane too, even though he's never flown one before. Lowering the bar to his chest, Braden is halfway there. Braden raises the bar but, halfway through the lift, the bar begins to slowly move downward. The spotters lift the bar from Braden's chest, and Bobby B wins the bench press contest among the guys. Everyone congratulates Bobby B, giving him a generous supply of high fives. The group comes upstairs, quickly spreading the news of the bench press competition. Bobby B tells Kathy, "You might want to order a few more pizzas. We all had a good workout." Kathy asks, "Seriously?" Mark replies, "Yeah. We all worked out for an hour, on top of the competition." Kathy calls the pizzeria, adding a few pizzas to her order. A little later in the morning, Kathy still perceives something is bothering Karen. Seeing Karen sitting alone at a table at the far end of the pool, Kathy walks over and takes a seat. Kathy opens the conversation by asking, "So, what's your story?" Karen asks, "What do you mean?" Kathy explains, "Well, to start with, you're a freshman, and running time's more like a junior or senior." Karen replies, "Since I was in sixth grade, I rode my bicycle everywhere. When I got to high school, I was faster than most of the guys. So, the gym teacher suggested that I try out for the track team." Kathy comments, "Hmm. Riding a bicycle. That's exactly how Eddie got so fast." Karen casually mentions, "I really wish I had my bicycle here with me at the university." Kathy suggests, "Maybe you can bring it back with you when you come back next year." Karen informs Kathy, "I'm not exactly going home over the summer." Kathy asks, "Really? What are your plans for the summer?" Karen replies, "I haven't quite figured it out yet. Something will work out." With Karen not going home and no plans for the summer, Kathy is definitely wondering what's up with Karen. Knowing that the summer day camp that Kathy worked at for the past few years has an opening, Kathy mentions to Karen, "If you're looking for a job, the summer day camp that I used to work at has an opening. They called me late last week and asked if I could work for a few weeks until they find someone else. It's really fun, if you like working with kids." Suddenly excited, Karen exclaims, "Really? Do you think they'll take me?" Kathy suggests, We can go down Monday morning, and I can introduce you. Quite grateful, Karen replies, that would be awesome. Thank you so much. Suddenly getting excited, Karen then mentions, wow. If this works out, that would be so great. If I get the job, then I can find a place to live. They won't let me live in the dorms unless I'm enrolled in classes. Quite perplexed, Kathy asks, how do you mean, now, I can find a place to live? Where are you living now? Karen replies, since after the semester was over, I've been living out of my car. I've been getting a shower in the gym and eating at the school cafeteria. Kathy asks, wait. You're living out of your car? Karen replies, yeah. I'm not going home, so I don't have much choice right now. Something will work out. I have some money saved because I had a job on campus this past year. But I've been saving that for food. Kathy tells Karen, hun, you're sleeping here tonight. You're not sleeping in your car anymore. Happy that she'll have a bed to sleep in tonight, a tear begins to fall from Karen's eye. Barely getting the words out, Karen tells Kathy, thank you so much. Are you sure it's okay? Eddie won't mind. Kathy assures Karen, it's okay. No problem. Now curious, Kathy asks, how are you not going home? Karen explains, I can't go home. I just can't. My mother is forever yelling and screaming about everything, and my father just doesn't see it. He's always at work, and she's a little nicer when he's around. You know, I've never realized this before, but since I was born, I've been in fight or flight mode. When I came to the university, I realized how peaceful life can be. Then, I went home over Christmas break, and it was the same old shit all over again. I just can't go back home, Kathy. I just can't. Not even for a few months. Kathy compassionately tells Karen, I am so sorry. I can't even imagine. Karen tells Kathy, so, the reason I run so fast is because I have to be fast. I'm on full scholarship, and I can't afford to lose it. So, I train every chance I get. And I heard what Mr. Fraser said, so I'm going to train all summer too. Kathy encourages Karen, it really shows in your performance on the track. If I am not mistaken, you've improved more than anyone on the team since the fall. Karen then tells Kathy, between my scholarship and my job on campus, I made out pretty well this year. I just can't go back home. Kathy reassures Karen, we'll get this to work out somehow. We'll go down on Monday and talk to Mrs. Jensen, the summer camp coordinator. She's really nice, but I'll warn you. She's a total space cadet. Karen asks, a space cadet? How so? Kathy laughs and explains, yeah. One day, she came into the gym and told me, it's Wednesday. You're supposed to be outside with the kids playing kickball. So, I told her, it's raining. So, we're staying inside and hula hooping. And then she stares at me all weird-like and tells me, oh. Karen laughs and tells Kathy, that's really kind of funny. Karen then shares, last winter, when Mr. Fraser took over as coach, we were doing relay drills on the first day of practice. Provost Layton found something wrong with my handoff. So, she pulled me aside and I thought I was going to get yelled at. But she was so nice. And that's another thing. The coaches at my high school were always yelling and screaming at the athletes. But whenever Mr. Fraser raises his voice, it's always something really encouraging. Kathy replies, he's like that. I only saw him get mad a few times. One time was when McCrutchen rammed the baton into my ass. Another was in high school when the Chucky threw a javelin at Eddie. Mr. Fraser stands up for his athletes. He has our back. Karen exclaims, wait. Someone threw a javelin at Eddie. Kathy explains, yeah. During a 440-yard dash time trial, the Chucky threw the javelin at Eddie. The javelin cut Eddie's leg, and when he went down, he sprained his hip. Mark and Johnson went down too. When he saw what was about to happen, Mr. Fraser told Erica to go and call the police. Then, Eddie kicked the shit out of the chucker like you wouldn't believe. Mr. Fraser and Mr. Zunday just stood there with their arms crossed and watched as Eddie pulverized the chucky into oblivion. The hospital tried to put the chucky back together again, but they weren't too successful. Karen asks, why do you call him the chucky? Kathy replies, because the chucky is more like an it than a person. The catering van from the pizzeria drives up, meaning the pizza has arrived. Kathy tells Karen, the pizza's here. Let's go help Ariana with the pizza. Kathy and Karen head toward the front door and are greeted by Eddie who, seeing the truck arrive, opens the door. Helping Ariana, Eddie, Kathy, and Karen each grab a few boxes of pizza, bringing them inside. As they are bringing the pizza in, Kathy tells Eddie, since school let out, Karen has been sleeping in her car. Eddie looks at Karen and mentions, you can stay here if you want. Karen replies, that's what Kathy said. You guys are so nice. Thank you so very much. Eddie tells Kathy, I'll go tell everyone the pizza is here. Over lunch, Kathy yells out, now that we're all together, I have an announcement. The room suddenly quiets down, and Kathy announces, I got accepted to graduate school, so I'll be at the university for another year. Everyone cheers, but there is little clapping because everyone has a slice of pizza in their hand. Kathy exclaims, but that is not all the news. I got a job working with the team, and I'm also going to be a scout for the team. Everyone cheers again, glad to hear that Kathy is going to be around in some capacity for the next year. Kathy looks over at Paula and asks her, well. With a mouth half full of pizza, Paula announces, ditto. I also got accepted to grad school. And I'll be working with the team too. Paula would say more, but she's more interested in eating her slice of pizza at the moment. Everyone again cheers, glad to hear that Kathy and Paula will be helping out with the team next year. Once the cheering dies down, Amber exclaims, since we're all together, I have an announcement too. With a silence in the room, and everyone waiting a little longer than expected for Amber's announcement, Barbara yells out, out with it, girl. Amber tells everyone what she has been waiting a few years to announce. Gary has proposed, and I accepted. We're getting married. Cheers again rise, with a few people commenting, it's about time. Amber has been waiting to make this announcement for a very long time. Mitchell, however, seemed to be in no rush to pop the question. After lunch, everyone heads back outside to the pool. Standing in the corner at the shallow end, Braden mentions to Eddie and Mark, now that Dean Grimsby is gone, it looks like our team is really strong. Eddie replies, yeah, I know. It will be really interesting to see what happens next year when the events aren't rigged. Braden asks, have you heard anything from Officer Hayes? Eddie replies, yeah. He was on vacation for a week. He came into the station a few days ago and told me what happened. Eddie, seeing Johnson nearby, yells out, yo, Johnson. Come here for a minute. Johnson swims over, and Braden asks, how did it end up going down? Eddie explains, when they took Grimsby for a drive, they convinced him that the guy who took the bet, some guy named Bill Fusco, was dead on the bottom of a river somewhere. They told Grimsby that, if he didn't take them to the boss man, he was going to end up on the bottom of a river too. Braden laughs, exclaiming, I heard part of that. Mac was wearing a wire. I would have liked to be along on that ride. Mark comments, yeah, seriously. Braden adds, those undercover guys really know how to play the part. Eddie continues, so, the boss man turned out to be Mr. Crumb's uncle, Alistair Crumb. Mark exclaims, "That guy must have boatloads of cash. He paid me for the wall that I built in all cash. That wall was about 1,000 feet long. I had 12 jobbers on that project." Braden, using his officer's demeanor, throws out, "I wonder who they were trying to keep out of there." Mark replies, "You, bro, and the rest of the police." Johnson exclaims, "You got that right." Braden suggests, "I bet there's a few safes in that house, loaded with cash." Eddie explains, "So, here's where it gets good. They made a bunch of other arrests, but wait." Eddie yells out, "Yo, Barbara. Come here for a minute." Barbara walks over, sits on the pool ledge, and asks, "What's up?" Eddie catches Barbara up on what happened with Dean Grimsby, then tells everyone, "So, two of the people they arrested were Mr. Ruff and Mr. Parker. Richard said they were working together. And, you'll never believe this. Mr. Ruff was working with McCrutchen's father and McCrutchen's two brothers to rig the events. But, listen to this. Mr. Ruff and Mr. Parker tried to work with Mr. Crumb, but Richard said that Mr. Crumb didn't have enough control over his high school teams." Braden exclaims, "That explains a whole bunch of shit." Mark replies, "Seriously, bro." Johnson concludes, "Mr. Zunday really got in the way of Mr. Crumb controlling the teams. If it wasn't for Mr. Zunday, we'd all be screwed." Barbara comments, "I guess we'll not be seeing Mr. Ruff and Mr. Parker anymore. Now, I'm thinking about what their teams may really have." Johnson tells Barbara, "I guess you'll find out soon enough." As the conversation winds down, Eddie comments, "It looks like Tessa is practicing for our rematch." Barbara watches as Tessa does a flip turn, commenting, "Her flip turn has gotten really good." Eddie replies, "I see that. I'm going to go chase her down." Eddie pushes off the wall and swims after Tessa. Wanting to gauge his performance against Tessa's, Eddie swims as fast as he can to catch Tessa. Catching up with Tessa at the far wall, Eddie does his flip turn, passing Tessa. Quickly figuring out what is going on, Tessa quickly picks up her pace, not wanting to be shown up by Eddie. Now in direct competition, Eddie and Tessa battle it out as a few of the team members gather to watch the race. The problem is, however, there is no defined endpoint of the race. Kicking off the wall simultaneously with Tessa, Eddie is convinced his flip turn remains stronger than Tessa's. Allowing Tessa to catch up, Eddie then attempts to outpace Tessa's stroke. Giving it all she has, Tessa is making Eddie work hard. After a few laps, Eddie concludes Tessa is still faster in the water, but he is much more superior in the flip turn. With a few weeks before the rematch, Eddie knows what he needs to work on. Tessa, along with everyone watching, thinks Eddie is racing her. Eddie, arriving at the wall first on this lap, stops. Tessa also stops, and Eddie wastes no time telling her, "I won." Tessa quickly replies, "We weren't racing." Eddie replies, "Yeah, you're right. That was just a leisurely afternoon swim." Tessa exclaims, "I'm beating you this year, buddy." Eddie replies, "No, you're not." Tessa exclaims, "Oh yes, I am." Kathy, standing with Karen Coy and Leslie Collins, comments, "This year's rematch looks like it's going to be interesting." Leslie asks, "What rematch?" Kathy explains, "A lot of us get together at the county pool over the summer. For the last 5 years, Eddie and Tessa have raced in the pool. Some years, Eddie won and some years, Tessa won. And, occasionally some others would join in on the race." Karen mentions, "I'd really like to see that." Kathy tells Karen and Leslie, "We'll let you guys know when the get-together is. It's really fun." After the unofficial race in the pool, most everyone sits back and relaxes. At the deep end of the pool, Tessa practices her flip turn across the short dimension of the pool. Pushing off the wall and, with not even taking a stroke, Tessa arrives at the other wall, doing another flip turn. A few athletes go downstairs to the gym, work out a bit, and head back upstairs. Amber, all excited, tells everyone of her and Gary's wedding plans, which really haven't been well thought out yet. Once everyone has left for the evening, Kathy tells Karen, "Let's go out to your car and get your stuff." Kathy, Eddie, and Karen head out to Karen's car. Karen opens her trunk, where Karen's stuff, as Kathy put it, amounts to three small suitcases of clothes and a radio. Karen also has a box in her trunk containing her notebooks and school supplies from the last semester, but there is no reason to bring those in. And Karen gets her pillow and blanket out of the back seat, and they all head back inside. Inside, Kathy, Eddie, and Karen go to the spare bedroom, where Kathy suggests the dresser and closet are totally empty, so you can put your clothes there. Karen asks, "I thought I was only staying for tonight." Kathy replies, "Hun, you're not sleeping in your car anymore. You can stay here until school starts if you need to." With tears of happiness, Karen warmly replies, "Thank you guys so much. You are so nice." Kathy helps Karen unpack, as Eddie heads off to do something else. While they are unpacking, Karen puts her radio on the nightstand. Kathy mentions, "That's a really cool-looking radio." Karen explains, "Yeah. It's AM, FM, shortwave, and it receives weather broadcasts. When I was in middle school and high school, I had my earphones in all the time, listening to the radio, so I wouldn't hear my mother screaming. Now, I mostly listen to the campus radio station. And when I wasn't listening to my radio, I was probably out riding my bicycle." Kathy asks, "Did you hear Ed's interview on the campus radio station?" Karen replies, "Yeah. I heard that. It was really good." Once they are finished unpacking, Kathy and Karen walk into the kitchen, where Eddie has finished sorting out the leftover pizza. Eddie asks, "Pepperoni, hamburger, or veggie? Or we can go out." Kathy replies, "It's late. We're having whatever is in the refrigerator." Tonight, Kathy, Eddie, and Karen make dinner out of whatever they find in the refrigerator. After dinner, Eddie tells Karen, "The thermostat's on the wall in the living room. Set it to whatever you want. The food is in the refrigerator and in the pantry. Help yourself to whatever you want. The gym is downstairs and the pool is outside. Enjoy yourself." Kathy adds, "And the bath towels and stuff are in the linen closets on either side of the bathroom." Karen again tells Eddie and Kathy, "You guys are so nice. Thank you very much." Karen heads to the shower, and we'll get to sleep in a real bed tonight. Monday morning, Kathy and Karen wake up early and head to the day camp to hopefully find Karen a summer job. Karen asks, "Can we ride in your June buggy?" Kathy replies, "I was hoping you'd want to. It's really nice outside." Kathy and Karen get into the June buggy, heading to the summer day camp where Kathy worked since she was 16 years old. Arriving at the day camp, Karen mentions, "This isn't too far from the university." Kathy explains, "It's not far from my parents' house either. When I worked here when I was in high school, I used to ride my bicycle. I was so glad when I got my car, though. On sunny days, I would ride my bicycle. On rainy days, I would drive. Oh, and Paula used to work here too." Arriving at the day camp, Kathy and Karen jump out of the June buggy and head inside. Walking into the office, Kathy knocks on Mrs. Jensen's door, who is doing some paperwork. Mrs. Jensen smiles and asks Kathy, "Have you reconsidered? Can you work this summer?" Kathy replies, "No. But Karen wants to apply. She's on the track team with me at the university." Looking at Karen, Mrs. Jensen asks, "Let me guess. You're Karen?" Karen replies, "Yes, ma'am." Hearing that Karen is on the track team, Mrs. Jensen hands an application to Karen and tells her, here. Fill this out for me, please. While Karen is filling out her application, Kathy asks Mrs. Jensen, "You haven't found anyone to take my place yet?" Mrs. Jensen replies, "I've had a lot of applications, but no. The two open positions are for physical fitness instructors, not for arts and crafts. I got tons of arts and crafts applicants. You and Paula spoiled me." Kathy asks, "So, you need two instructors?" Mrs. Jensen replies, "Yes. By next week. I'm really down to the wire here." Listening as Mrs. Jensen and Kathy talk, Karen becomes more optimistic that she will get the job. Kathy tells Mrs. Jensen, "I know someone else who might want the other position." Mrs. Jensen tells Kathy, "Really? Please send him or her by. As I said, I'm down to the wire here. I need two instructors by next week." Karen hands Mrs. Jensen the completed application. Mrs. Jensen explains to Karen, "The kids here in the day camp are from 1st to 6th grade. In gym class, they are in a class with kids their own age. We also teach various arts and crafts classes and music classes. And occasionally there are field trips to the beach, parks, and places like museums." As Mrs. Jensen is reviewing Karen's application, Mrs. Jensen asks Karen, "Do you think you can be a gym teacher, psychologist, babysitter, school nurse, and referee all at once?" Karen replies, "I think so." Mrs. Jensen then asks, "Do you know the rules for kickball, basketball, badminton, volleyball, and softball?" Karen confidently replies, "Yes, ma'am. I do." With the surprise of the day, Mrs. Jensen then asks Karen, "Can you start next week?" Karen smiles and replies, "I certainly can." Mrs. Jensen and Karen work out the details as Kathy sits back relaxing, glad to see that Karen got the job. As Kathy and Karen get ready to leave, Mrs. Jensen asks Kathy, "You mentioned someone else might be interested. Who was that?" Kathy replies, "Amber Amy. She's also on the track team at the university." Mrs. Jensen asks Karen, "Do you know Amber Amy?" Karen replies, "Yes. We're on the track team together." Kathy already told Mrs. Jensen that Karen and Amber are both on the track team. Karen is beginning to understand why Mrs. Jensen might be a bit of a space cadet. Before they leave, Kathy incidentally asks Mrs. Jensen, "Would you, by any chance, be related to Dr. Jensen, who was a track coach at the university years ago?" With her eyes opening wide, Mrs. Jensen replies, "I am, by marriage. He's my father-in-law. He started this day camp 15 years ago. It was supposed to be a physical education day camp. But the enrollment wasn't too high, so we added arts and crafts the next year. We added music classes right before you started years ago." Kathy replies, "Wow. It's a small world." Holding her blue stone in her hand, Kathy wonders if the stone has anything to do with her thinking Mrs. Jensen and the former track coach at the university are related. Kathy and Karen then head out, back to Kathy's house. When they get home, Kathy tells Karen, "Hey, why don't you call Amber and let her know about the job at the day camp? I'm sure it's right up her alley." Karen replies, "I can do that. It would be really nice to work with someone I already know." Karen, whose summer just got a whole lot better, makes the call to Amber, hoping to make her summer a lot better too. While Eddie is at work one day, a familiar face drives into the service station, that of Jimmy O'Brien. Still working at the burger joint downtown, O'Brien is proud that he was quickly promoted to being a manager. But being a manager in a burger joint means O'Brien is on salary and doesn't get paid for the long hours of overtime he puts in. For the last year, O'Brien frequently drove into Angelo's service station to fill the tank of his new Mercedes, which was purchased with funds made through illegal gambling. This time, however, O'Brien is driving an old AMC Gremlin. As he pulls up to the pumps, Jimmy O'Brien waits for someone to come out and greet him. O'Brien, for some reason, likes to see Eddie filling his gas tank. Seeing who is behind the wheel, Eddie takes a break and goes out to the pumps. Seeing O'Brien, Eddie asks, "What happened to your Mercedes?" O'Brien replies, "I don't have it anymore." Eddie asks, "Oh yeah. What happened to it?" Evading the question, O'Brien replies, "I bought this instead." "So, you're still pumping gas?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. I'm still pumping gas." O'Brien tells Eddie, "Fill it up for me." Eddie replies, "Yeah, sure. No problem." As he is filling O'Brien's tank, Eddie quickly concludes what happened to O'Brien's Mercedes. Eddie has figured out that O'Brien's Mercedes was purchased with the proceeds from the gambling operation that Officer Hayes busted wide open. Concluding that O'Brien's Mercedes was, in part, purchased with a bank loan, Eddie figures that O'Brien had to unload his luxury vehicle and buy something from a buy here, pay here lot. Eddie has also suspected that Mr. O'Brien is involved in the gambling ring, but, for some reason, Officer Hayes has not yet taken Mr. O'Brien in. O'Brien hands Eddie a large bill for his gas purchase, purely to impress Eddie. As he is slowly counting out O'Brien's change, Eddie mentions to O'Brien, "So, the gambling operation went south. I suppose that's why you lost your Mercedes. I'm guessing your father lost his Mercedes too." O'Brien angrily replies, asking, "How do you know about that?" Eddie confidently informs O'Brien, "Everybody knows about it. Mr. Crumb is sitting in jail. The oddsmaker, Grimsby, is sitting in jail. The Centerville coach, Mr. Ruff, is sitting in jail. I could go on. That whole ring was busted wide open. And they know your father was involved in the gambling ring by failing athletes." Then, to purely irritate O'Brien, Eddie tells him, "I heard they are not finished making all the arrests yet." O'Brien, wanting more information from Eddie, starts to sweat and asks, "Who else are they arresting?" Eddie hands O'Brien his change and, purely to further irritate O'Brien, tells him, "I'm not allowed to say. Good luck. And stay out of trouble." Eddie heads inside to continue working on the engine he is repairing. O'Brien starts his engine, leaving a cloud of blue smoke, suggestive that his rings or valve guides are worn. Making a beeline back home to tell his father what he just heard from Eddie, O'Brien is clearly stressed. Later that week, on a day after a heavy rainstorm, when Eddie returns from work, Kathy announces, "Hey, Eddie. Let's go and look for more blue stones." Eddie replies, "That was really spontaneous, Katerina. Why today?" Kathy replies, "Because it rained really hard yesterday and last night. It might be easier to find one now." Eddie asks, "How are we getting there?" Kathy suggests, "Let's drive. We can park at the middle school." Eddie cleans up from work, then they get into Eddie's MGB and head to the middle school. Sliding through an opening in the fence near the maintenance building, Eddie and Kathy walk toward the rocky outcropping where they found two blue stones in early spring. On their walk, Kathy tells Eddie, "I know we're going to find more blue stones today." Eddie replies, "You sound very sure of yourself." Kathy smiles and tells Eddie, "Superpowers." Arriving at the rocky outcropping, Kathy and Eddie carefully look around. With the recent rains, the rocks and stones have been washed clean. And in the afternoon sun, many of the stones glitter in the bright sunlight. It doesn't take Kathy long to exclaim, "I found one. Eddie, I knew I was going to find one today. And I did." Seeing the stone, Eddie tells Kathy, "That one is really beautiful." Kathy puts her newly found blue stone into her pocket and carefully searches for more. Among the rocks are various types of stones, not just blue stones. Eddie finds another yellow stone in the same location that he found the first one. Seeing that the stone is very similar to the other he found a while ago, Eddie puts it in his pocket. Searching a little further, Eddie yells out to Kathy, "I think I found another blue one." Looking around, Kathy makes note of where she was and rushes over to see what Eddie found. Under some gravel which has washed away is a blue stone, partially buried in the dirt. Kathy and Eddie move the dirt away, quickly finding that this blue stone is much larger than they ever thought. Using a tree branch as a shovel, they slowly unearth the stone. As they are digging, Eddie comments, "I think we found the mother stone." Kathy replies, "Yeah. This one is huge." Seeing another yellow stone nearby, Eddie picks it up and puts it in his pocket and continues working. After digging for a while, the blue stone begins to loosen up. Kathy mentions, "We almost got it." 2 minutes later, they finally manage to get the stone out of the ground without damaging it. Eddie tells Kathy, "Wow. You're not exactly going to be wearing this one around your neck." Kathy exclaims, "Yeah. I know. This one weighs a lot, like a pound." Admiring the stone, Kathy tells Eddie, "This stone is so, so beautiful. I can't believe we found this." Eddie asks, "What are we going to do with it?" Kathy replies, "First, when we get home, I'm going to wash it. Then, I don't know. Maybe I'll put it on my dresser." Eddie carries the large blue stone around as he and Kathy search for a few more precious stones. On their search, Eddie suggests, "Maybe we can come back here with a front-end loader and dig this place up." Kathy replies, "Hmm. I don't know. That might take the fun out of finding them." Looking around, Eddie mentions, "There aren't any rocks like these anywhere else around here. I wonder why they are all in this little area." Kathy replies, "I never thought about that." Eddie adds, "And then there's the portal. All along that path to the beach, there are no other boulders." Kathy replies, "That's really weird," as she is looking down, thinking she has found another blue stone. Seeing another blue stone, Kathy announces, "Eddie, I found another one. Wait, there are two of them here." Eddie walks over to take a look, seeing a small blue stone, like the others they've found. Eddie relates, "You're having a good day. I've never thought, Katerina, that a blue stone would make you so happy." Kathy reminds Eddie, "Blue stones have superpowers. Remember?" Eddie shows Kathy the two yellow stones he found. Kathy mentions, "Those are really pretty too. I wonder if they have superpowers." Kathy and Eddie search for another 30 minutes, finding no more blue or yellow stones. Kathy tells Eddie, "I guess that's all the stones we're going to find today. But finding one large and three small blue stones, Kathy is very happy." And with two more yellow stones, Eddie and Kathy wonder if they are special too. Eddie drives home, while Kathy examines her prized stones very carefully on the way. Out of the blue one day, Mark gets a phone call from Louis Zeno. When Mark was a sophomore in high school, Zeno was a senior. While Zeno wasn't the fastest guy on the high school track team, he always managed to come through when the team needed him to. And Zeno was always helping the freshmen and encouraging them every chance he got. Zeno asks that Mark meet him at the high school track. With little information why Zeno wants to meet, Mark heads over to the track, wondering what's up with Louis Zeno these days. Mark arrives at the high school, seeing Zeno walking around the track, checking it out. Walking across the red zone, Mark yells out to Zeno, "Yo, bro. What's going on?" Zeno yells back, "Mark. It's great to see you again." Walking across the red zone holding a long cardboard tube, Zeno meets up with Mark, exchanging fist bumps like they did 5 years ago. Mark and Zeno catch up on the past 5 years as they walk toward the starting line. Zeno mentions to Mark, "I saw your sign across the street where the church is being built." Mark replies, "Yeah. Me, my father, and Eddie's father are building the church for Dr. Akinmola. His son, Adekunle, is on the track team with us at the university. He showed up at the high school the year after you left. Zeno asks, so, you're going to the university and you're working? Evading the question since he does not attend formal classes, Mark replies, yeah. Sort of. Mark then mentions, the church will be done by Christmas. The plan is to have it ready for the first service on Christmas Eve. Getting down to business, Zeno tells Mark, I was hired by the school board to convert this track to the metric system. Mark exclaims, wow. Is that what you went to college for? Zeno explains, yes. I went to college to be a landscape architect, but I'm specializing in sporting venues. Right now, there's a lot of tracks around that need converting. Every track is a different story. Mark comments, that's really cool. Zeno continues, but, I got a problem with this track. It's too big. Pointing to the inside cement curb, Zeno explains, I got to rip out this curb and move it in a few centimeters. Thinking that moving a curb would be not much of a problem, Mark replies, that should be easy enough. Zeno further explains, on a metric track, the 400 meters is measured at 30 centimeters from the inside of lane 1. Each lane has got to be 1.22 meters wide. So, the curb has to come out. I had the surveyors out here 2 weeks ago, and they already measured it. Backtracking, Mark asks, how did they come up with 1.22 meters? Zeno laughs and answers, 1.22 meters is 4 feet. That's what the lane width is on an English system track. They just converted 4 feet to metric and made that the metric standard. So much for the metric system. Mark replies, yeah. Really? Quite curious, Mark asks, so, on a track, the actual distance is measured how far from the inside of the lane? Drawing an approximate line in the gravel with his foot, Zeno replies, in lane 1, the 400 meters is measured 30 centimeters from the inside of the lane marker. Mark asks, so, if I run closer to the inside line, I'm running a shorter distance. Zeno replies, yes. In lane 1, on the line, it's almost 1 meter shorter on a 400 meter track. Mark replies, that's good to know. Zeno tells Mark, I design the track, but I don't do the actual installation. If you have the time, I'd like to hire you to install the new design. Mark asks, what's involved? Zeno explains, first, the curb has to come out, and we have to install a new one. They've decided to keep it a gravel track for now, but the contract says to replace the existing gravel. But, I designed the track so it can be easily converted to an all-weather surface when the time comes. I already have the calculations for the new track. Let me show it to you. Mark and Zeno walk over to the team bench that they have sat on for years, where Zeno pulls the blueprints for the new track out of the cardboard tube. Seeing the blueprints, Mark exclaims, wow. This looks really professional. Did you do this yourself? Zeno replies, yes. Zeno has two sets of documents, each with several pages of drawings. The first set of documents is an as-built survey of the existing track, and the second set of documents are the blueprints for the new track. Familiar with reading such documents, Mark studies the survey and blueprints. Walking over to the track for a moment, Mark returns to examine the documents again. Mark asks, are you changing the diameter of the curve at all? Zeno explains, no. The curve diameter on this track is already correct. That's a big help. Mark suggests, I wouldn't rip the old curb out just yet. Zeno asks, what are you thinking? Mark explains, the new curb is far enough in that the old curb could be used as a guide for the concrete forms. We'll just put in the proper size spacer and use that for the outside form. That will save you a lot of time and money. Understanding that accurately installing the forms for the new curb is quite a monumental task, a smile comes across Zeno's face. Zeno tells Mark, I never thought of that. The standard way of doing things is to rip out the old stuff, then get the surveyor in to lay out the new track. The forms for the curb are manufactured in a factory to my specs, and I have to install them. Then, once they are installed, we pour the concrete. Mark replies, that seems like it would be way too complicated and really expensive. Seeing the light, Zeno comments, I can see that now. Zeno then informs Mark, I'm working on a few other tracks right now too. One of them is over at Centerville. Mark asks, oh yeah. So, they're converting to metric too. Zeno replies, in a way. On that track, lane 1 is about 2.5 yards short of a 440. It's already a metric track, but they sort of have it calibrated in yards. So, if you run the 440-yard dash on that track, in lane 1, you're really running the 400-meter dash. And, where the markings are engraved in the curb for the staggering, the outside lane is actually something like 448 yards. Whoever calibrated that track couldn't have made it out of the sixth grade. It's a mess. Fortunately, over there at Centerville, 100 yards really is 100 yards on the sprinting track. Quickly figuring out what Zeno actually said, Mark comments, so, Centerville has been cheating all these years. Zeno replies, it would seem that way. If I remember, they weren't a very good team anyway. Mark adds, they weren't. No wonder their relay team got to state every year. Zeno tells Mark, so, for that track, I'll get the surveyor out there next week and have it properly recalibrated. While they are on the subject of Centerville, Mark informs Zeno of the plight of Mr. Ruff, the Centerville coach, and the gambling operation that was busted wide open. Zeno tells Mark, another track I'm working on is the one over at our middle school. When I was in middle school, I always thought that track was a circle. Mark mentions, that's weird. I always thought that track was a slightly flattened circle. Zeno explains, it's really neither. That track is the most lopsided oval I've ever seen. Where the 440-yard track abuts the sprinting track, the 440-yard track is straight for 60 yards. On the other side, the 440-yard track is straight for 30 yards. And, technically, that track is 441 yards long. When they put that track in, they measured the lane distance at the curb. Whoever put that track in never had a moment of sobriety. Mark asks, what are you going to do? Zeno replies, for that track, I have to rip it out and start from scratch. But, we'll get the one here at the high school done first. Walking around the track, Mark and Zeno talk a little more about business. Mark is glad to pick up a job that is interesting to him. And Zeno is glad to hear that, between Mark, Mark's father, and Eddie's father, they all have the expertise to get this, and similar future projects, done. Zeno informs Mark that the high school track is slated to be installed over the winter next year. That is good news to Mark, since the church construction will be finished by then. Over at Angelo's service station, things are going rather well for Angelo and Eddie. Occasionally, however, a repair does not go as well as originally planned, and the customer returns with a complaint. When a difficult client has a complaint with a repair, sometimes the situation can get a little heated. But Angelo and Eddie can handle just about anything. Today, as Eddie and Angelo are working together on finishing an engine rebuild that has to be completed by tomorrow, a customer walks in who is not too happy with a repair done to her vehicle last year. Walking into the service bays, a woman interrupts Angelo and Eddie and yells, "One of you, get out here right now." Angelo comments to Eddie, "Wonderful. One of those again." Eddie looks behind him and tells Angelo, "That's Mrs. Black. She must not be too happy with her Johnson rod." Mimicking Mrs. Black's demeanor, Angelo yells back, "What's your problem?" Looking at her service ticket from another auto repair receipt, Mrs. Black yells back, The Johnson rod you put in last year broke. I thought you put in a good one. Eddie asks Angelo, do you want me to take care of her? Angelo replies, sure. Go ahead. Just get rid of her. We don't have the time for her shit today. Eddie replies, got it. Eddie walks over to Mrs. Black and asks, so, your Johnson rod failed. Mrs. Black yells, they said it was bad. I thought you put in a good one. Mrs. Black shows Eddie the service receipt from Jake's garage, a repair facility on the other side of town. Eddie calmly tells Mrs. Black, come into the office for a second. Let me see what's up. Eddie gets on the phone and calls Jake's garage. Jake answers the phone and Eddie asks, hey, Jake. Eddie here. How are you doing? Jake talks with Eddie for a moment as Mrs. Black listens to Eddie's side of the conversation. Eddie then tells Jake, hey. I have Mrs. Black here. I replaced her Johnson rod last year. She tells me you recently replaced her Johnson rod. Jake replies to Eddie, who hands Mrs. Black the phone, telling her, here. He wants to talk to you. Mrs. Black talks with Jake, who discusses the situation with her. Eddie listens, as Mrs. Black seems to be very agreeable as Jake explains the issue. After a 2-minute conversation, Mrs. Black hands the phone back to Eddie. Eddie asks Jake, did you clear it up for her? Eddie listens to what Jake has to say, then tells Jake, okay. Thanks. Eddie tells Mrs. Black, so, what did he tell you? Mrs. Black explains, he said, on my model car, since it's a V8, there are 2 Johnson rods. Eddie replies, exactly. There's one on each side of the engine. So, one lasted a little longer than the other. Is there anything else we can do for you today? Mrs. Black, quite embarrassed over her lack of automotive knowledge, tells Eddie, no. But, why didn't you replace the other Johnson rod last year? Eddie replies, because it wasn't broken. If we replaced it, and it wasn't broke, you would have gotten mad at us. Mrs. Black leaves, now appreciative of the fact that both of her Johnson rods are in good shape. Eddie returns to the service area, announcing, she's gone. Angelo asks, what was her problem? Eddie explains, Jake replaced her Johnson rod. I got him on the phone. He explained to that idiot that, on AV8, there are 2 Johnson rods, one on the left side of the engine, and one on the right. Angelo laughs and admits, wow. I didn't know that. You learn something new every day.